You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
Robin, a passionate advocate for wealth building, didn't begin her journey in finance. Raised by a truck driver and a school teacher, she learned the value of hard work and saving, but lacked knowledge about making money work for her. As a financial advisor, she brings empathy and understanding, having experienced different financial stages herself. With qualifications like CFP and CPWA, Robin values her human touch. She's held various jobs, from fantastic to challenging, respecting the effort people put into earning their wealth. Robin spends most of her day in her chair serving clients. Her passion lies in sharing knowledge through public speaking, writing, and teaching, helping people grow financially. Robin is here to support you on your financial journey and secure your future.
You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
How are you?
I am well. How are you doing today?
I am wonderful. I know that people can't see your face, but I love the voluptuous hair. I love a good blowout.
Thank you.
That is voluptuous. Yes, I see you. I see you, queen. What is in your coffee cup? What are you drinking with us today?
So just plain old water. I always drink water when I'm recording to help my voice and everything. So nothing fancy, just water today.
Regular degula water or sparkling? Sexy water.
Regular water.
Okay.
Well, you know, going for the sparkling, but since I was speaking, you know, I was like, let's just do the regular schmegular.
Okay.
H2O.
Okay.
So.
Okay. I love it. And where are your people from? And how has that encouraged, inspired where you are today?
Sure. So I'm from Louisiana. I was born and raised in New Orleans. And, you know, I've done some research into ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that my family has a long history of entrepreneurship. And actually of land ownership. So I found this absolutely fascinating. I want to know more. Of course, the records are very spotty, you know, but my family was one of the, on my mother's side, was one of the first Black families to own land in Louisiana after Reconstruction.
Really?
Yeah, you really wonder how that came about, right? Because that
yeah.
was really a very friendly time for Black people and Black families. And they ended up acquiring a lot of land, held on to that land until about the 1970s. And then there was oil found on the land, which became kind of a family dispute when the land was, the oil rights were sold to major corporations. But it's fascinating history. I would love to learn more about that and how that came about. You had pretty smart to get land as a Black person in Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, you know, Louisiana.
Oh, I want to know. And when you find out, let me know, because I want to do a whole podcast on that, because I want to know what great, 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 great grandmother figured this out and got it done for the people. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you're from New Orleans, we also cannot continue this conversation without discussing New Orleans food.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We need a moment of praise for New Orleans food. So what is your favorite? I am, you know, I do love a Miss Chase gumbo for folks who know or don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
But like, what is your mama making up in the kitchen in your New Orleans home?
Sure. So I'm looking forward to gumbo. Like everybody family does it a little bit different. And when,
right.
you know, gumbo, it's not something we eat every day. It's like something, you know, you make Christmas and Easter because it's very expensive and time consuming to make a gumbo.
You got to have a good roux. You got to have a good roux.
And you got to have like, it's probably about $80 to make like a proper gumbo and you have to,
oh, yeah.
they do it. So I'm looking forward to my dad's gumbo when I go home for Christmas. Two restaurant recommendations if you find yourself in New Orleans. Best Jazz Brunch, Quarter Two Sisters in New Orleans.
I love the Quarter of Two Sisters.
Amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yes.
Experience. Second one, I'd be surprised if you heard this one because it's mm-hmm. still New Orleans. If you know, you know. Two Jacques.
I've been to Two Jacques.
You've been to Two Jacques. Okay, yeah.
So fun fact is that
uh-huh.
my dad's graduate program. So my parents had me when my dad was in graduate school, and his graduate program was in New Orleans.
I remember you told me that.
So I spent 3 to 4 years there when I was very young. And I always tell people, I remember like leaving, kicking and screaming. Cause I was like, why would we leave this city? What decisions are these adults making?
Yeah.
So New Orleans is a very special place in my heart.
It's an incredible city. I mean, it's none of, whenever I dream of home, I dream of New Orleans.
Have you recently seen the High on the Hog season 2?
No.
Episode about New Orleans? Robin, you need to go and get your life.
High on the Hog. Okay.
I'm going to put it on the show notes. You got to go get your life about your people. So High on the Hog, It's this wonderful documentary on Netflix about Black American food and where it started from, how it got here. And so every episode talks about a specific food. And season two just aired and they did a whole thing on New Orleans. And I just sat there and like slobbered all over my remote.
Well, you know, the thing that remarks, like when I go back to New Orleans that I noticed, especially like in the French Quarter, there's music everywhere. There's a kid sitting on a street corner with buckets doing drumming. Or, you know, you hear music coming out of a shop or you hear music in a car. It was a society that was instrumental in building the pillars of American culture. Jazz originated, you know, in New Orleans. The cuisine is unique. It is so one of a kind and is so instrumental in American culture that I'm always proud to say I'm from New Orleans.
I love that. But you're currently not in New Orleans. So how did we go from Little Robin in New Orleans to where you are now?
Big journey. Love New Orleans. There's nothing like it. Whenever I dream of home, I dream of New Orleans. Unfortunately, there's not very many jobs there. Outside of tourism and a few other industries, pretty much if you're young, Black, and talented, you know there's a good shot you're going to have to leave to find the job that you want. So I came out to California in 2005, almost 20 years ago, for a JOB. Okay, that's where the money was. That's where the jobs were. And, you know, you at that time, you were expected to follow the money, and that was all there was to it. So I came out in 2005, and off and on, I've lived abroad. I've always come back to California, changed careers many times, ended up as a wealth manager, very happy with the job that I have now. But it was the job. It was a JOB that brought me out to California.
So you are a wealth manager. I always tell people you are the wealth manager. The number of times that I have sent out your email address is actually insane. Because I'm like, she knows what she's talking about, family. Okay. And I'm so excited for this conversation because even in season one of this podcast, as we record season two, the amount of times that the conversation about money comes up with other guests and their lessons that do not have to do with money, but the fact that they acknowledge there is also a foundational financial component to be able to do certain things in your life, in your career, to be able to have the flexibility to make certain decisions is important. And that's why I'm excited to talk to the wealth manager 100% about money, because the topic, Robin, continues to infiltrate almost every person that I talk to, even though we don't go deep into it.
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. I mean, money is an energy and it allows us to do certain things in our lives. And, you know, wealthy people have a definite energy about themselves and how they move in the world. You know, middle class have an energy and people who are poor have an energy too. And so you're absolutely right. It permeates pretty much everything from everyday decisions to those very, very large decisions, where we live, where we work, even who we love in some ways is determined by money.
So let's go deeper into that. So you are a wealth manager. What is a wealth manager? Because, you know, people hear the term financial advisor. People hear the term like go talk to Auntie Bessie, who's just really good at pinching those pennies, you know, in her piggy bank behind the oven at home. What is a wealth manager versus all those other things?
Sure. So a wealth manager is basically a fancy word for rich people's financial advisor.
Okay.
And, okay. You know, I am a financial advisor too at my core. The longer I did this work and the more I began working with high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals, the work becomes more rarefied. And, you know, it moves more into the realm of taxes. Actually, tax mitigation.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of the work I'm doing right now is around tax mitigation, but my heart is actually as a financial advisor. So, but you know, I am a wealth manager, but I love the work of being a financial advisor for everyday people.
And why do you love that so much? Why is that like your passion? Because I just saw your face light up like a Christmas tree when you said that for the part about for your people. Why is that like your heart and spirit?
I feel this work as an industry is becoming more rarefied. you know, you have to have a certain amount of money to sit in a financial or wealth manager seat. And that always, it rubs me the wrong way. And I'm part of the problem in some ways. I am a wealth manager, but the people who really need the knowledge aren't getting it, right? You know, if you're helping some multimillionaire mitigate their taxes, how does that impact society? How does that impact our community versus helping a family figure out how to pass on, you know, their values as generational wealth to the next generation? One thing I just didn't anticipate in this interview when I became a wealth manager is how rarefied the work quickly became. And, you know, my heart is with people, with the, you know, helping people deal with the real deal problems of money.
What are some of those real deal problems? Before we go into wealth, from your experience, what are some of those real deal problems with everyday money? Not people who are wealthy, not people who, you know, have millions in the bank, but just regular folk who are just trying to make ends meet. What do those problems look like?
People aren't taught about money. People are taught virtually nothing about money. And we live in a very financially complicated society with a lot of very complex financial instruments. And, you know, there's loans, there's home mortgages, there's car loans, there's credit cards, there's student loan debts. People often don't understand what they're getting into when they sign these documents. And it's not that wealthy people have some other plane of knowledge, and, you know, people who are not wealthy just don't have access to that knowledge. I think we have more access to knowledge now about money than at any point in history. But I think the root of the problem is we don't really educate people about their money. And I also think we have so many complex financial instruments that didn't exist two generations ago to deal with money.
I come from a family, roots in the South, but both my parents were born and raised in the Midwest. So I was born and raised in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
We never talked about money.
Mm-hmm.
And fun fact, and I'm gonna snitch on myself, my mama gonna be mad because she'll say that we did talk about money. And I'm like, we never talked about money. We talked about save your money.
Right.
Right? My grandmother loves saying that, save your money. But we never, other than that, we didn't talk about money.
Right.
And I've met a lot of people my age, in my generation, especially who look like me, who have a very similar story. In your opinion, why is that?
I think there's a lot of fear and shame about money. Like, if you don't have very much knowledge about money, what do you tell your kids? You know, you tell them to save, right? That's a middle class thing. Save your money, right?
Yeah.
You're telling their kids to invest their money. But we never heard that. My mom was a school teacher. My dad was a truck driver. We're middle class too. I got the save your money thing, but they didn't know what to do beyond that because nothing existed beyond that. You know, you think about the 1980s, how to trade a stock or a mutual fund, you had to have a trader, right? You had to get on the phone with someone who was a trader who could make that trade for you because there was no internet. My parents didn't know any traders. They didn't know any stockbrokers. They didn't know anybody who did this type of work. And so if you weren't in the know, you were just locked out. You told your kids to save. A lot of people told you what they knew. They gave you what they knew, which was correct to an extent. It's how to be middle class, but it's not how to be wealthy.
I think my first like real lesson and understanding that I had to learn about money was when I went to college. And I went to undergrad and there were all these rich kids. And just even though we were all 18, which I think that there are a lot of similarities of all 18-year-olds around the world, which is basically young, dumb, stupid, and excited. So we all had that in common, but different financial brackets. And I remember going to lunch and going to dinner and like going to see my roommate who was in a definitely different tax bracket than I was, and just listening to them talk about money. And we're just talking about like buying a smoothie on the college campus. It was a different conversation than I would have talking about buying a smoothie. And that's what really sparked my interest, or at least sparked me to understand that, like, I don't know a lot. I need to figure it out. So in your opinion, let's talk about a hypothetical 18-year-old. With your knowledge and expertise, what are some tips and tricks that you would give them right now about financial advice at 18 years old?
That's an excellent question. You know, I think back when I was 18, 25 years ago or 26 years.
They don't need to know. For the record, you look like 21, okay? Robin's still getting carded in the club. Don't play her. Don't play her.
Many moons ago when I was 18, there was just, you know, there was no internet. That was just the beginning stages. There weren't all of this resources of information. And what I would tell an 18-year-old now, person graduating high school, especially if they're going on for a 4-year degree, is do your research. You know, there was actually a great article that came out, I believe it was in the New York Times, where they talked about different degrees and basically who earns money with a college degree. Now, I'm a huge fan of the humanities. I'm a huge fan of art history. That's a hobby. Okay. It's not, if you're rich and you're well connected in the art world, then go ahead and get that art history degree and become an art historian. Okay. Because you have the money and the connections to make your career like that happen. If you're a middle-class Black girl from Louisiana, you better get yourself into some science, engineering, law, medicine, or business, right? Because my family didn't have any of those connections. We didn't have any of the money to move into certain circles. And so I would tell that 18-year-old, if you're going to university, be very careful and very strategic what you major in. And I know like the psychology and the English history people will come for me every time I tell people this. You know, I get someone who majored in like basket weaving who's going to come for me because, you know, I'm talking dirty about their major. But hey, the purpose of a 4-year degree is to get you a job out of college, right? And there needs to be a clear path between what you were spending 4 years studying and that job. So I would tell, you know, middle-class Black girl from, you know, deep South, major in something that's going to make you money. Go back and get the art history degree at when you're 50 and you major money and you can do whatever you want, but you need a JLP.
You can also get a dual degree. No one is saying that art history ain't it, you know, maybe get a minor, like no one, you know. Yeah,
you can, but I wish I could find this article for you. They really did the research and they looked at different economic brackets to say how things turn out if a person has a, you know, philosophy degree versus a business degree. And it's most important for poor and middle class students to have the quote right major. If you're rich and well connected, you can do what you want because you're basically riding on your family connections or you're riding on, you know, other resources.
And you already have the foundation of the money.
Yeah.
So you're coming into college with a financial foundation. I think that's what I hear you say.
Right.
Versus kids who are walking into this 4-year institution.
Right.
To start this new experience, understand that you may not be walking in with that same foundation, financial foundation that your peer may have.
You're probably taking out a lot of debt to get that. Whereas rich kid isn't taking out a lot of debt, right? Mom and dad is covering the whole tab. So you have to look at it as a return on investment.
Mm.
I always tell people, one thing I tell 18-year-olds when I am able to kind of corral them in, because you're right, it's all about just getting out in the world and living. If you're planning to go to a 4-year school and you're planning to major in something, figure out what you anticipate your first year salary will be. If you're majoring in social work, you know you're not going to make $130,000 your first year out of school.
Okay.
Whatever your anticipated first year salary, you do not borrow above and beyond that, because that's when people get into real trouble with the student loan game. So if you're going to be a social worker and you know the first year out, you're going to earn $60,000 working for the state, that's it. That's all you can borrow. Do not borrow more, because you're going to find yourself in hot water with that. You know, a lot of people wish they would have figured that out. They figure it out on the other side when they're struggling with abnormally high student loan debt payments. And, you know, they're in a field that just doesn't pay what is needed to pay back a $100,000 loan. And then they're in trouble. There's nothing I can really do for them at that point other than telling them to get another job, earn more money, or change fields entirely. It's a very pivotal age in many ways. Like I've seen people make financial decisions that completely mess them up for life. At 18, we don't want to dismiss you for being able to lay the foundation for wealth. And if you're poor and middle class, be very strategic in what you're going to major in and figure out how much you anticipate making that first year of work. And don't borrow beyond that.
So let's also up level this, because it's not just 18-year-olds who need money advice, as you know.
Yeah.
I always tell people, you know, the little bit that I know about money compared to you, like I have a morsel compared to you. I'm always like, it's always a good time to start figuring out your money at whatever age you are at.
Right.
Let's talk about the professionals in the world who may be getting a salary, small, large, and different, but are living paycheck to paycheck, which I know for a fact there are statistics that show that the majority of people in the world do live paycheck to paycheck. Whether their paycheck is $10 a year or their paycheck is $300,000 a year, they are living paycheck to paycheck. I want to talk to you about that. What are your tips and tricks for that person to start not living paycheck to paycheck?
And you're absolutely right. I mean, I can show you people earning like $500,000 a year, $750,000, like salaries that are just absolutely staggering, who are living paycheck to paycheck. And if something happened to their job, they'd be homeless the next month because they have nothing. They spend to the hilt and beyond, you know. And wealth is always built in excess. You got to have something left over at the end of each month to build wealth, right? So if you're earning $750,000, but you're spending $850,000, you're forever broke. You are not going to be wealthy. If you're earning $75,000, but you're spending $50,000, you're actually in a better position than the person who's earning $750,000, but spending $850,000. So it shifts people's thinking when you kind of explain it that way, because wealth is always built in excess. And if there is no excess, there is no wealth. How do people end up in situations like that where they have like a staggering high salary, but they're spending well beyond their means? Cars. I hate cars. Like, I've seen people shoot themselves in the foot, bury themselves over some trinket of a car. I understand you want to drive something that's safe, reliable, and nice. That doesn't need to be $80,000. It doesn't need to be $100,000. For some car enthusiasts, I get it. But, you know, for the vast majority of people, something safe, efficient, reliable is what you need, and leave it at that. I have seen people completely obliterate their finances over a car, and it never ceases to amaze me, and it shocks me at the same time. So cars are like the number one thing that I tell people to really take a look at. Overbuying of homes, you know, especially when there was a run up in prices of homes, especially during the pandemic, there was kind of this, I mean, you swear we were running out of homes. You know, if you didn't get one now, you weren't going to get one. And a lot of people ended up overbidding and overbuying a home only to regret it not so long in the future later. You really take stock of what you need. Okay, if you're a single person, do you really need a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home? You know, even if you have a family of four, do you need 5 bedrooms or 6 or 7? It's very easy to get sucked into thinking you need a lot more than you really need. But when you're tethered to these enormous mortgage, property tax, maintenance payments, it's absorbing all of your wealth. And you never know. Few people stay in the home for 30 years. So odds are you're going to sell that home before 30 years.
At some point.
You may not get your money back, because a lot of people who had to sell recently sold at a loss. So I wish people would be more strategic and more thoughtful about what they really need, and not overbuy a home. So cars, overbought homes. Another favorite one. Lexi, you're earning $500,000 a year.
Let's put it out there. Let's bless it. Let's manifest it. Okay.
You got to listen to the second part. Your family's basically on your payroll. Right. You start.
No. See, Robin, you know me well enough. That's going to be an absolute no. But go ahead.
It happens. Right. You know, I have clients who grew up in difficult circumstances. They're doing phenomenally well. They earn $500,000 a year. Suddenly they're covering their cars, the brother's car note. Suddenly they're covering their auntie's PG&E bill. Suddenly they're covering, you know, their cousin's son's college tuition. Basically, when you look at their finances, their family are basically obliterating their wealth. And they can't say no, right? Because they're the only one that kind of, quote, made it out. And they're expected to help everyone else. And those situations are really, really difficult to manage. But the only way to combat it is really by start saying no. But, people feel obligated, family relations, this person is angry, or the family, you know, steps in. I've seen families actively manipulate people. It really happens a lot. It happens a lot.
So what I hear from you in those small examples, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that in order to create wealth and therefore have generational wealth for the next generation of yours, you have to live below your means. That's what I hear you saying. Whatever your means are. So if my means are $100 a year,
yeah,
I shouldn't be spending $120.
Whatever your means are.
Period.
Whether those means are, you know, $75,000 a year or $750,000 a year, you know, you have to live below it. You know, a lot of millionaires drive very basic cars. They just don't care about cars.
You know, they say that Warren Buffett still drives that, I forgot, it's some like 1970 station wagon. And he's publicly said it. He's like, I don't need a Porsche for what? Yeah.
I'm sure he really, when he goes out, he has a team of securities and he's probably in a, you know, a bulletproof convoy.
Of course. Yes.
It is true that there are a lot of millionaires who drive like very basic cars. And I'll tell you why they drive very basic cars. A, they don't really care about the car, right? It's basic transportation. It just needs to be safe, reliable, get them from A to B. The second reason that they don't really want to drive fancy cars, they don't really care about the car, is you're driving some big fancy car and you rear end somebody. Okay. Especially in California, they're going to know you have money. They're going to look you up. They're going to realize you have money. It increases the odds that you're going to be caught up in a lawsuit, whether it's a meritless lawsuit or it's a merited lawsuit. I drive a 10-year-old Toyota and I'm a wealth manager. Nobody going to say nothing about me. Nobody's going to carjack me. Nobody, you know, is going to try to rear end my car to get a lawsuit going. It's just not that impressive. So a lot of wealthy people drive basic cars just to be incognito and not draw attention to themselves and their wealth, because it's a very real concern.
I mean, you know, shout out RIP to my gray Honda that I got a week after I graduated from college a long time ago. She died last October in an accident, but I was going to drive her until she died. It was wonderful.
Right. That was the right attitude. Hondas, Toyotas, Subarus, you can drive those things forever if they're well-maintained and, you know, routine scheduled maintenance is done. You know, I understand that at certain stages of lives, things change. Like with a child, it may no longer make sense. But I just see people, they buy new cars every 3 years or so. And it's like, why? I don't understand why you need a new car. This $1,000 a month car payment is chewing up what could be used for generational wealth. The car is probably going to be in a junkyard in the next, 7 to 10 years. And that money's flown out a window.
I heard you speak once where someone asked you, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically they said, you know, I make X amount, I save my money, but I want to save more. How do I do that? And your response was it was entertaining and eloquent. And basically you said this thing that I want to talk about, which was, you don't make money by saving money. You make money by making more money. And the audience had this huge aha moment. Because again, most of us are taught save your money. I would love to go deeper in that with you when you said you don't make money by saving more money. You make money by making more money.
It is true. And there's a second part of that I didn't get. I remember saying that, but there was a second part that I'll go into you. So, you know, we're all taught to save, and saving is very good. But beyond a certain point, saving really doesn't serve a point. I typically tell people in most professions to have anywhere from 6 to 8 months of savings. I have artists and, you know, actors and painters, et cetera. They're more like a year of savings because their income is very irregular and it comes in like large amounts of money at certain times of the year and can't really be calculated. Once you put that in a savings account, you know, beyond that, you really should be investing, not saving. And, you know, having savings is great, but at a certain point, you really should be looking to earn more money. The middle class ethos is that we're going to work our way out of every situation, meaning we're tempted to go get a second job. And it's kind of like, why are you going to do that? There's only 24 hours in a day. You're already working an 8-hour job. You're going to go and put in 5, 6, 7, 8 hours in a second job. Sure, it'll bring in more money, but you're going to burn yourself out and you're going to be completely exhausted. Why not figure out how to earn more money at the 8-hour job that you're in and then take that extra money and put it towards investments, not savings? Because once you have 4, 6, 8 months of savings, you're set. That's your emergency fund. So it's really pulling a lot of the middle class people out of the savings mindset and putting them in the investment mindset, which is difficult because it's not what we're taught to do.
It's in our blood, Robin. It's in our blood. I'm literally, as we're talking, like hearing my grandmother who died in 2019, like I can like hear her spirit right now in this room. Save your money, girl. Save your money. It's you know, it's in the DNA.
That's all we could do as Black people, right? We did not have access to capital markets. We did not have access to loans and leverage and things that other communities had access to build. The only thing we could do is pretty much save our money and pray. And that's the way it was basically until our generation. I mean, like a woman couldn't even open a bank account in her own name until the, I believe, the early 70s.
I think it was like 73 or 75. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like 5 or 6 years before I was born.
I love telling people that. I love telling people that my generation is the first generation in the United States, at least for Black women, that was born with the right to have a savings account and that was born with the right to vote.
Right.
Which is crazy.
What could grandma tell you but save and pray? And that's what our grandmothers, my grandmother told me both. And you know, the thing is, my mother, who was part of the silent generation, so she's even before baby boomer, right? She was, she's almost 80. She tells me the same thing, save and pray. Right? That's all Black people could do. Now we have so many other tools available to us to create wealth. So, you know, we're at the start of the race, a race that some people have been running for generations, but we finally got to the start line. And I think that ties back to the question about being a wealth manager. You know, I feel like I'm coaching people who are already at the finish line versus people who are starting the race or running.
Which is different.
It is very different.
So what is the best way to grow our money?
It depends on the person. And I say that because you also have to take into consideration a person's risk tolerance.
Of course.
One thing I've learned as a financial advisor is you never want to push someone into something either they don't understand or they're not ready for. There are people who I put into CD ladders because that's just all that they can handle. They cannot handle the stock market. I have a lot of clients from Argentina, right? And you know, the Argentinian, you should read about the Argentinian economy, very interesting economy. They experience hyperinflation, you know, like 100% inflation overnight. They also went through a long period of political turmoil, right? Very dark times. And these clients who are kind of raised in this environment and experience these very dark times, they're shell shocked. They have very specific views about money. And you know, it's because they were basically traumatized because they grew up during the military junta of the, you know, 70s and 80s, and when things were really tough in Argentina.
So are they more likely to want to hold the money? Like they want to see their money?
Yeah. No, okay. They want to see money. They don't believe in investing, simply because the economy in Argentina was such a basket case. I have clients from Zimbabwe who are the same way, who experience just complete basket case economies. And you have to move very slowly and very patiently. And sometimes all they can handle is a CD. And that's okay. Let's just put in a CD. It's getting someone's feet moving. So it depends on where the person is. If they're very risk aversive and they have really good reason to be risk aversive, right now CDs may be fine. Okay. I'm still going to work with you and I'm going to work on you and we're going to talk. You know, every time I see you, we're going to talk. I'm going to explain the stock market. I'm going to say, hey, you know, the CD is coming due. Instead of putting this into another CD, let's take 20% of it and put it in the stock market and 80% of it and put it in the CD. So for some people, it's a work over time. For people who have more risk tolerance and are ready to jump in both feet, the stock market is a good place to start. Beyond that, there are other investments, but I always go at it with caution, such as private equity, hedge funds. Those are very complex financial instruments. They lock up your money for a long period of time. They often depend on the skill of the fund manager. And so typically those are investments for people who are already wealthy. For people starting out, middle-class folks, stock market is often the best place to get started. People ask me about real estate. Potentially, it could be a good investment. But, you know, my problem with real estate is that it's offered to people as a passive investment where you don't really have to do anything. You have to do a lot of work for real estate.
Look, Robin, I bought, and I think you know this, I bought my first home 2 years ago real estate is expensive.
It sure is.
And it requires a lot of time, effort, energy, patience,
yeah,
and prayer.
Yeah.
Especially right now with this, with the 7-8%.
Put a tenant into your house and you got a whole other ball of fun to deal with. You know, I always say real estate is toilet, trash, and tenants. And if you don't want to deal with toilet, trash, and tenants, you don't want to deal with real estate. So, you know, anytime a client is telling me they're looking at real estate, I really do quiz them to make sure they understand what they're getting into. It could be great for the right person, or it could end up being your worst nightmare. It's not really passive. There's no such thing as passive income. I firmly believe there's no such thing as passive income. There's always some degree activity, oversight, work that's going to be required.
That's interesting because, you know, I think because of the internet, social media, et cetera, everybody's trying to get into real estate. They think it's like this easy peasy thing. And I'll be the first one to say, I thought it was an easy peasy thing until I bought my first home. And then I was like, oh, this is not as easy.
No.
As Instagram said it would be.
Yeah, I hate social media, and I'll tell you why in a moment. I just bought my first home in San Francisco. Within a week of moving in, the washer dryer quit and the heating doesn't work. That's several thousand dollars out the window right there. I haven't even been in this place for 2 weeks. Okay.
And this is SF. You need your heat, folks. I know that we're in California, but in San Francisco, you need heat.
But let me rip on social media right now, because I really got a bone to pick with social media. I really feel it is one of the most destructive elements to wealth in America right now, because it depicts it in such a way that it oversimplifies a lot of financial concepts, and it displays wealth in a way that isn't authentic. You know, you think, if you look at social media, you think if you're not a millionaire by time you're 23, there's something wrong with you. That's not the way it works. That's just not the way it works. You know, the average person becomes a millionaire in their late 40s, 50s, or beyond. They also make it seem like living an ordinary life is an abomination, or you're doing something wrong if you're living an ordinary life and working a 9-to-5. And, you know, everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Some people are natural entrepreneurs. Some people need to stay away from entrepreneurship with a 10-foot pole. You know, there's a lot wrong in social media with a lot of depictions of wealth. That being said, there are really good channels out there, especially on YouTube, that take a really balanced approach to wealth building. Okay. And, you know, I could look at it and I could tell in an instant, like, the real from the fake, right? But this is what I do for a living. So I know the good advice, the trash advice, and everything in between. The average 18-year-old is looking at this and probably won't be able to tell the difference between what is good advice. And so it does take a keen eye to be able to tell some of this, but a lot of what you're seeing depicted on social media is not accurate in the least. And I think it ends up leading people down some very misleading paths where they can easily get themselves into situations that are very difficult to manage.
Well, I think like in social media, you have a lot of people who are social media influencers or content creators. And so you're looking at their stuff. You're looking at them, you know, every other month flying first class Emirates to somewhere. And you're not thinking about, they're getting paid to do that. So not only are they having this experience, the experience is paid for by someone else. They're not paying for it. And for all I know, they live in the shoebox down the street. I don't know. Blessings to them, right? Also, as you mentioned that, and I'm going to put it in the show notes, I recently read an article about 2 weeks ago that just came out. I wonder if you read it, where the title was something like, most millennials think you need right under $600,000 to be happy. And they did this data collection and, you know, this talking about this, the mental illness of this idea that for you to be between the ages of what, 28 and 45, and you think that if you do not make about, I think it was like $578,000 or $600,000.
I did read the article.
That you are absolutely nothing. And the mental and emotional effects on those humans all the way to suicide, mm-hmm, because of this distortion of what you should be financially right now.
Right. I did. I was surprised and not surprised at the same time. I'll tell you why I'm not surprised. You know, even myself, you know, I was born in 79. I'm in my mid 40s. between when I was born and now, you look at things like housing, education, and healthcare have become staggeringly expensive. You know, I was looking at my college tuition when I was, you know, 18 to 21. There's preschools that charge what I was paying for college tuition just 20 short years ago. Healthcare is, there's double digit inflation in healthcare every single year. Housing, you know, for what I paid for a 650 square foot condo in San Francisco, I could have bought like four or five of my childhood homes in New Orleans. And that scares the hell out of people. It's hard even to nail the basics, which is housing, education, and healthcare in our society without bare minimum a six-figure income. And millennials and Gen Zers know it. They've seen this rapid inflation of the basic. So when you ask them how much they need to live, they're pricing in the inflation in the future, because housing is not going to become cheaper. Healthcare is not going to become cheaper. Education is not going to become cheaper. So they're pricing in all of this inflation, and they're coming up with some super staggering figure of $600,000 to live. Do you know what sliver of the American population earns $600,000? It's less than, you know, 1-2% earn in that price range. But they're giving you that outlandish number because they're pricing in the inflation that they know is going to continue for housing, healthcare, education. So in that way, I'm not surprised. The way that I'm surprised is how many people think they're actually going to earn $600,000 in a year at any point in their lives. You have people who think they're going to earn $130,000 right out of college.
And for the record, some people do, but most people do not.
Some people do, but you know, most people do not. And you know, the surefire way to find out is to do your research, right? Talk to people who are doing what you want to do out of college and ask them, say, hey, I'm doing some research to make a decision on this major. Can you tell me how much you earned in your first year?
They'll tell you.
They will tell you. It surprised me, but it didn't surprise me. I think people are afraid, and they should be, because the things are becoming so staggeringly expensive that only the wealthy or the near wealthy will be able to afford the basics.
What I'm concerned about is, well, what you said, like just be able to afford survival. But what I'm also concerned about is perception versus reality, and this perception that you have to have all this money to be happy. Because I fundamentally believe that you do not have to be a millionaire to be happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But if we have all these images and stuff telling us you have to have $600,000 in the bank to be happy, because happiness is defined by this set of experiences that only people who make that much money can afford, then now we're entering into this depressive, not healthy space of a generation of people who are just insanely unhappy and sad because they've been taught that you can't have these experiences that are over their means. And that's my concern.
You also have to consider this. I know people who are earning, you know, $600,000-$750,000 a year. You know, at that level, you're basically like the LeBron James in your field. Like you must be, you know, top of your legal game, top of your technology game, top of your wealth management game to really be earning that much money consistently every year. The amount of work, time, and pressure that goes into earning that often will tax your mental health to the hilt.
Most people don't want to do it, Robin. Most people don't want to do that work.
Fantastic rewards are not given in exchange for nothing. If a company is paying you $750,000 a year, they're going to take it out of your high. They're going to work you to death. They're going to take your weekends. They're going to take your summers. They're going to take your evenings. You know, I have clients who like text me at 2 a.m. in the morning and they're up because they're expected, you know, they got work. But guess what? I'm up at 2 a.m. because I got work. You know, you these jobs that pay well and are prestigious will take it out of your high. And you have to be prepared to turn over your high at any moment to get that $750,000 a year. The vast majority of people either don't want to do that or can't do it for a sustained period of time. Entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, boy, they are complete head cases because they really have to give their all to this endeavor.
100% of the time.
150%. They give themselves, they often give their families, their marriages, their kids, you know, their health to make it. So there's no fantastic reward without a fantastic request attached to it, right? And if you want to be at that level, there's no problem with wanting to be at that level, but you're going to have to give up a lot. You're going to consistently have to give up a lot. And you have to ask yourself, do you really want to consistently give up a lot? If you don't want to, that isn't a problem. You know, you can find a job making $100,000, $150,000 a year. You can still become a millionaire. It's going to take time, but you'll have your you have your weekends. You'll have your health resources. You'll have your family resources intact.
So in closing, what, if you had to sum it up very quickly, what is one thing that the average person can do right now after listening to this episode of this podcast to start building their wealth?
Well, that's an interesting question.
And I know everybody's different, so I'm sure it's a hard question because, you know, everybody's different. We all got unique situationships.
Okay.
But if there was like one tip that you would love to say, like, just start doing this.
Okay. I'm going to take it back to grandma and mom.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say, because a lot of people don't have any form of savings, right? Like, how many people you talk to really have 6 to 8 months living? Not many. Most people don't even have like $1,000 saved. And life happens, you know, things, medical expenses, car, house, et cetera. If you don't have anything in savings or you only have a couple of $1,000, I usually start off by telling people you need to save first. Even before like taking people's money to invest it, if the person doesn't have savings, I won't invest for them. So, you know, grandma was right. On some level, grandma was right. Save, you know, and if a person came to me, they were just starting out, they didn't have anything, they needed to start down the journey of wealth, I would say start a savings account as a first step.
But you know, right now in the corporate world, we're seeing a huge increase in layoffs.
Right, right.
And it's interesting that when I talk to people about their layoff journey, just the tone of the voice, when you have someone who's gotten laid off mm-hmm. and has no savings versus someone who's gotten laid off and has 6 months to a year in savings, it is a different conversation, Robin.
Night and day. Yeah. And, you know, I preach it to the skies. Please have savings. Please have savings. Please have savings. And the clients who didn't have savings, boy, they were panicked. When laid off. And, you know, I'm like, look, you need a JLB. You need a JLB now. You better hit the ground running. You gotta nail this. You know, the clients who had a runway, some were able to take a hiatus. You know, some people were very burned out. Some people were very emotionally, you know, affected by the layoff. They were able to take time and reset themselves and then continue on their journey versus you need a job, you know, by next month, or this is going to get real ugly real quick. So it's real. It happens. Life happens. I've seen the weirdest things as a financial advisor. I've seen clients inherit millions of dollars and drop dead, you know, 2 weeks later. And that actually recently happened. You know, I'm a big proponent of getting all your accounts and getting a beneficiary set up because it happens. You know, I've seen people who've had fantastic jobs who thought they were going to last forever get laid off. I've seen people go into events of disability. You know, layoff is one thing, disability happens, you know, and you got to come up with that money and pay the bills during your period. You're sick. And on top of that, you're worried about how you're going to pay your bill.
Look, Robin, I keep saying it, life be lifing. Okay. And there's a lot that we cannot control in life.
And it happens to everybody. At least once something's going to come and take you by surprise and money's going to make it better. Money's going to make it, if you got it, you can roll with it. If you don't, yeah.
So basically, it's interesting. We've come full circle. So to go back to Mama Robin and Grandmother Robin and great, 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 great Grandmother Robin who bought all that land, save your money, baby.
Save your money. Save your money.
Save your money.
Get the savings together. I've never met a rich person who didn't have some form of savings.
And then once we save our money, then we can graduate to the next level and contact you and possibly do some other interesting things with that. That's what I hear.
That's when we start investing. But you know, for the going back to the 18-year-old, I would say, you know, get out of college, live like a pauper for the first few years. You know, if you can live with mom and dad to pay off any student loan debt and get some savings, that.
Do it.
Do that. I know it's tempting to elevate your lifestyle, but you'll have a whole lifetime to do that. Give it 3 years to basically focus on paying off your debts, getting your savings together, and then starting your journey.
So how can we follow you? What are you doing next? How can we support it? How can we be in your orbit to continue to get this knowledge?
Sure. So in addition to being a wealth manager, I'm also a public speaker. I love speaking on generational wealth. It's something I'm personally passionate about. I have a website, robinpatan.com, where you can learn about me as a speaker and also learn about me as a wealth manager. I welcome conversations with people, you know, and I'm very receptive to women, people of color, because I know how hard it can be and intimidating it can be to get in front of a financial advisor. And so, you know, I want people to connect with me, reach out to me. My information is on the website. You know, I do have conversations. A half an hour conversation is sometimes all a person needs to set them on the right trajectory.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Robin, for just continuing to do what you do, for always answering my emails. More importantly, for just continuing to do what you do and do it so vulnerably and so candidly, but also just so lovingly. Because you're right, this conversation about money is a vulnerable and scary conversation for most people. And what I love about you the most is that when people talk to you, or even when you're speaking about money, it's very candid, it's very honest, but no one leaves feeling shamed. And I think in this particular topic, that is the most important thing.
That is my intention and my hope. I never want someone to leave my office or leave a conversation feeling like a lesser being because of their financial situation. And I feel there's so much in our society that makes us feel judged or less than or otherizes us in our finances, that should be part of the code of ethics of financial management and financial planning, is that a financial planner approaches it with empathy and understanding.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to spend time with you.
You can listen to You Can Sit With Us episodes on Spotify. For more information, visit our website, lexib.com, and our LinkedIn account at LexiB. And make sure to follow our podcasts on Instagram at Sit With LexiB. And don't forget to subscribe to our Spotify channel.